This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervy.
Good evening, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I have some assistance from my guests. I have a jam-packed show today, and I'm excited about it. No co-host, of course, Carrie Kasem, no longer my co-host, but I think we're going to have her back in a few weeks and talk about a few things that she's been doing since she moved to Florida. And I've been having guest co-hosts, which have been great, but today I'm flying solo. I guess a lot of people have something more important to do, like watching a football game or something like that. I want to get right down to it because later in the show, we are having Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss on the show. They are the filmmakers behind Boys State. This is an acclaimed documentary that so many people are talking about where high school boys learn the political system through a week-long exercise in self-governance that takes place, in this case, in Austin, Texas. So Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss will tell us about their film, which is at 94% on the tomato meter on Rotten Tomatoes. A really interesting film that you should take it in and learn a little bit about not only the political system, but high school students participating in the political system. Before we get to that, we are going to talk about grown adults participating in the political system. And who better to talk about that than Congressman Brad Sherman. Brad Sherman has been on our show before. And by the way, Carrie Kasem really liked Brad Sherman. She leans to the right in her political perspectives, but thought that Brad Sherman had a lot of really great stuff, pragmatic things to say about so many different topics. He is a wealth of information. He's the congressman for the 30th Congressional District, which is in the San Fernando Valley, most of the San Fernando Valley. He's serving in his 10th term in Congress. He served in the House of Representatives since 1997, a senior member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, a senior member of the House Financial Services Committee, a member of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee. He is very, very well-rounded, probably what we would say is a Renaissance man. And Brad Sherman had quite a scare, like everyone else who was at the Capitol on Wednesday, January 6th. Brad, welcome back to Gervy's Law.
Alan, it's good to be with you. And I'm known as Brad Sherman from America's best named city, Sherman Oaks. And I want to give a shout out to the entire San Fernando Valley.
Yeah, not only Sherman Oaks, and I'd like to say that our law firm is located in Sherman Oaks, so we have a lot in common with Brad Sherman. You know, we don't have a last name Sherman, but we are in Sherman Oaks, Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, as is Congressman Brad Sherman, who represents the area, as well as far west as, what, Woodland Hills, Hidden Hills, and east you have, Chatsworth, and where else? Where does it extend to?
Chatsworth to Burbank, Porter Ranch, to Tarzana, the west and the south San Fernando Valley.
Wow, you got it all covered. And you are in Washington now as we start with this new administration. And things were a little bit rough. I know you wrote an article, or actually you were interviewed, talking about what happened on January 6th. And why don't you give us a little bit of an inside story of what you experienced? Because I know when I spoke to you earlier, a couple of weeks ago, you were saying that it was really, really frightening what was going on when the mob attacked the Capitol.
Well, to set the scene for you, the Capitol is the one building that's famous, connected by tunnels to about eight other buildings, including the Rayburn House office building, where I am right now. We knew that there were many thousands of Trump supporters that were going to be demonstrating outside the Capitol and in the environs. So I got to work early and used a circuitous route and thought that once I was in that complex of horizontal buildings, that my day was safe because it's been since the War of 1812 since anyone has breached the security of the Capitol. The security here looks very serious.
Did it look that way when you were going into work that day? Because you talk about, you know, going just another day, but there was talk of some of the things that were going to happen. And of course, with the speeches from then President Trump and others, did you see any reason for alarm going into your office that day?
I told my wife I'd be home about 3 a.m. because we expected that once I got into the complex, I couldn't leave until we were done. And we expected
right.
15 hours of challenges and debates and whatever. So I thought I'd be locked into the complex. You see all the checkpoints, and there are serious people, sometimes with machine guns, almost always with long guns as well as pistols. And you just get the feeling that, okay, nobody could cross that checkpoint.
Yeah.
And it's been invulnerable, and so it's never happened. So you expect that it can't happen. The fact is, and this is what the experts should have done, what happens if 50 people rush that site? And it turns out they thought of it just for a minute, and they told them, well, don't use deadly force. Well, if you've got a checkpoint with even 5 Capitol Police officers who are told not to use deadly force, and you've got 50 angry people rushing that checkpoint,
yeah,
you don't have security.
That equation doesn't work out well.
So here we had thought that the Capitol was invulnerable, and it's not. So I thought that the two interesting things would be, could I get into the Capitol complex, or would they try to block us outside to prevent us from voting? And the other thing would be, well, what does Mike Pence do? Because we're going to go through the alphabet. There's going to be a challenge to Arizona. And the Trump diehards had taken the position that Mike Pence could take the envelope from Arizona that's been certified to indicate how they're casting their Electoral College votes, take that envelope, throw it away, reach into his pocket, grab his own envelope, and announce that the Arizona Electoral College votes were cast for Trump. Now, Mike Pence knew that he couldn't do this. Everybody saner than Donald Trump knew that he couldn't do that. And I just wanted to see how he played it. And he played it completely straight. He did,
right.
he did what Al Gore did. He did what Joe Biden did. Both of them were vice presidents when we were handing over power to the other party. And so I went to the floor to see that. They don't want us on the floor too long. I saw that he handled Arizona the way he should. And I thought, okay, the rest of this day is just going to be very long, and we're going to be locked in here. But I brought my pillow, I brought my food, and I'm ready to go. Little did I know that about 20 minutes after I left the floor, the Capitol was breached. And you saw what happened. And I would have... Frankly, I learned more afterwards than I might have known at the time. The two or three things that concern me most are there's a range of people. The people who are here to demonstrate range from those who brought plastic restraints and envisioned themselves arresting members of Congress, conducting 10-minute trials and immediate executions, and those who came here as part of what they thought would be an angry, nonviolent demonstration.
Right.
And so there was a range. And there were people who brought guns and people who just brought signs.
So you thought they were the kooks and the radicals.
Yeah, a range.
A range in there.
The The right has produced a few pictures where they say, look at this person. They seem to be Antifa. You know, it's just a few people in this category. Two months ago. I mean, yeah. there are people who are anarchists who would be happy to be part of an angry mob, no matter what mob wanted to do. It's just, hey, it's a mob. I got to join it.
They're so not that astute people. About the politics, just about the procedure.
Right. Let's break something. If there had to be a slogan for the anarchist party, that's what it would be. Let's break something. In any case, most members were back in their offices. The word got to us quickly. Lock your door and don't make a sound. And we never had demonstrators in this hallway banging at the door. But what I learned, and we all learned later, is that some of this group was chanting hang Mike Pence,
right.
Where's Nancy? And they had constructed a little gallows outside. So there were at least a chunk of these folks who actually did dream were going to grab political officials, were going to tie up their hands, were going to put them on video, have a 10-minute trial, and carry out a sentence on a gallows. Now,
Did you seriously think that could happen? What was your mindset?
My mindset was this has never happened before. I don't think this is going to happen. On the other hand, I wasn't going to make any noise in the Rayburn House office building. Let them. This is an enormous complex that is mostly deserted, even on that day. I mean, usually you'd expect 20 people to be in my office. In fact, there were three. Most offices had one.
Yeah. The
whole place seems deserted.
But there weren't people around you where you were. No. Did it seem deserted while this was going on? You were just kind of waiting it out. You didn't peek your head out the door saying, is it safe to come out yet?
You do what they tell you. I certainly had access to the media here, and when I saw that there was tear gas in the rotunda, that was just a sad moment for me. But the very fact that people had broken into the Capitol was shocking and just leaves you wondering what happens next. But the fact is, we did evict these folks from the Capitol. We proceeded with our work. And I told my wife I'd be home at 3 a.m. I was home by 4 a.m.
Well, you were close.
Well, what happened was the demonstrators slowed us down by maybe 6 hours. And the Republicans dropped their challenge to at least Wisconsin. Maybe they would have challenged Michigan as well. So they went down to 2 challenges. And each challenge takes at least 3 hours. So, the Republicans went through with only 2 challenges, and we got done in the right place, in the right way, and the institutions of this country are strong.
Real quick, because we need to take a break, but do you think that the mob actually caused the challenges to be lesser in their severity or what they could have been? Because the way you're talking about it, after this occurred, it seemed to be a rather smooth process given the fact that shock had just taken place.
I think it caused Republican senators to want fewer challenges and to cut back to just Arizona and Pennsylvania. It did not cause House members. Remember, you only got 6 or 7 senators to vote to reject the Electoral College votes from any state. You had close to 160 House members, well over half of the Republican caucus. So you had a lot more supporters of the challenge. And had the challenge been successful, that would have kind of erased democracy in this country. Now, for it to be successful, it'd have to win both the House and the Senate, and that wasn't going to happen. But I think if you were going to spend 3 hours on a challenge, as long as one House member and one senator made a challenge, you were going to have plenty of House members make the challenge.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
But
well,
the Republican senators put themselves on a diet.
Well, I think most people are thankful for that, and we're thankful that everyone is safe. Well, most everyone, unfortunately, a couple lives were lost. But
we had Lyon in state in the rotunda, the police officer, who was killed. Yes.
Yeah.
And well, then we've had suicides of police officers as a result of, I mean, they've devoted their lives to protecting these buildings. They kind of feel that somehow the system let the country down.
Incredible.
We've had suicides.
Incredible, incredible. Well, we're going to move on. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go into the rapid round and get through some of the issues that you're dealing with now with the new administration. So we'll talk to Brad Sherman about that after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Here on Gervie's Law, I'm Alan Gervie. I'm talking to Congressman Brad Sherman of the 30th Congressional District in the San Fernando Valley. We just heard the harrowing story of January 6th when democracy was under attack, using Brad's words. Now, Brad, I want to talk a little bit about what's been going on since. And it's been a busy, busy couple of weeks. I think we're going to go through a rapid round. Can you handle the rapid round? Because there's a lot of questions. I'm just going to fire them at you. You answer them.
I'll do my best.
I think you can do it. This is like a game show. I'll do my best.
Okay.
All right. So here, let's start off with, I'm picking a topic from the hopper here. You were on CNBC Squawk on the Street on the GameStop trading frenzy. Have we seen the last of the Reddit GameStop manipulation of the market, and what can we look at in the future?
I think there's a new player on Wall Street, and it's the Reddit chat room. It's just one more factor. But I would say if you want, you know, we were seeing the casinoization of our capital markets, and that's not a good thing. You see Robinhood the website almost seems like a video game. If you want to play a video game, go to GameStop, buy a video game.
Right.
Don't go to Robinhood and buy GameStop.
I think GameStop has been closed mostly, but yeah, if it were open, you can get your video games there. Robinhood decided that it was going to prohibit customers from buying certain stocks. How do they do that? Isn't this a free market here for the stock market?
Well, their position is that they had to because in order to effectuate a trade on the clearinghouse, they had to post capital. Usually that's a small amount of capital, but the clearinghouse was demanding almost 100% capital for about a dozen very volatile stocks. I don't know if that's true or whether there was a nefarious effort to depress the price of those dozen stocks by not allowing Robinhood customers to buy them, although you could have gone to another broker. And what we should have is a circumstance where the broker isn't having to put up their own capital to facilitate a trade. If you've got $10,000 in your account, you want to buy $10,000 of GameStop, that's your business. It should be your money from the very beginning.
Right.
Not your broker's money for 24 hours and then your money. So we've got to straighten it out, whether it's the flash crash or whether it's GameStop. People ought to be able to transact their business efficiently.
Are you going to be involved with any measures moving forward through the committees you're on?
Yes. We're having hearings, I believe, next week We may have the CEO of Robinhood. We'll see. We'll be focused on this issue. I've got two bills we're working on. One is to require short sellers to be more transparent and to file documents with the SEC, and to parallel the rules of Europe and the UK, where if you short a stock to the tune of 0.5% of its outstanding shares, you have to disclose that and disclose it very quickly. The second thing is to try to prohibit Robinhood and others from providing psychic rewards and confetti to those who are engaged in short-term trading. Casinos provide psychic rewards, but we tax the hell out of them, so there's at least some social benefit.
Right.
We shouldn't have a casino psychic reward for short-term trading.
You know, I think the important thing, and we're going to move on to the next topic, but I think the important thing here is that there are measures that can address these issues, because there seems to be a lot of room for improvement here, both with the hedge funds and the Reddit people and everyone in between. So we'll look forward to hearing about how the committees go and the bills go. I want to change the subject to tax. You are, in your former life, tax law specialist, Harvard Law School, an attorney, CPA. Tell us about, quickly, what your feeling is with tax reform, if it occurs anytime soon, or if not, which we expect it won't so soon, why not?
Well, the biggest tax law will be the stimulus payments. We did $600 in December, and I expect there'll be more, but that the cutoff line will be lower, so that it may only go to people whose incomes are under $100,000 for an individual. And in LA, that may not make you a well-off person, but in much of the,
right,
we represent the whole country, and there are a lot of places where $100,000 puts you reasonably high up there. I think we may see the corporate income tax rate go up, but we've kind of are no longer tethered to dealing with deficits, and we should probably focus on that a little bit more.
Yeah.
But once, you know, if you're in the middle of passing an unpaid for $1.9 trillion bill, it's then hard to turn around the next day and say, let's go raise $50 billion by increasing this or that tax. I think eventually some of the Trump tax cuts will be rolled back, but not till the second half of this year at the earliest.
At the earliest, for sure. Okay, quickly before we take another break, because we're going to reserve the foreign policy to the last segment that we're going to talk to you. But before we get there, interestingly, you and Senator Feinstein introduced the Kobe and Gianna Bryan Helicopter Safety Act. Tell us a little bit about that and why it's important.
Well, we lost Kobe and Gianna just a little more than a year ago. And the National Transportation Safety Board had, over a dozen years before that, said that helicopters, particularly those carrying more than six people, should have a terrain awareness system and a data and flight recorder. And the FAA ignored that recommendation. They didn't completely ignore it. They applied it only to ambulance helicopters, which means they ignored it as to 99% of the
right.
helicopters. And as I believe that if this TAWS system had been on Kobe's helicopter, that we'd be seeing him
right.
today. And so,
and he would have enjoyed the Lakers winning the championship.
Absolutely, and would have been there. So I think that Vanessa has endorsed our bill, Vanessa Bryant, and require the implementation as a recommendation. We're up against two things. First, everybody's focused on COVID and all these other things. And then second, we're up against the helicopter industry fighting this tooth and nail.
Yeah.
So We'll try to get it passed. I'm hopeful the second half of this year, not as hopeful the first half.
I'm sure you have a lot of public support for that. Really quickly, you say you're up a lot against a lot of things. You're also up against the media coverage of the impeachment. I know it's a long topic, and we want to talk about foreign affairs after the break, but in a quick moment, tell us your thoughts on how the impeachment of the president in the Senate is affecting some of these measures that you're talking about that are important to a lot of other people.
The impeachment isn't taking up any of the House time. I mean, we have half a dozen or so members who are focused on it, but we're a 435 member organization. The Senate will take some time. I think the outcome is a foregone conclusion.
Right.
There are 45 Republican senators who will not vote to convict.
Yeah.
But it does serve a necessary function after the Capitol was invaded, that we've done what we can do to hold people, to hold the president, your former president, accountable.
But isn't there other means to do that?
Not really. I mean, one could imagine criminal charges.
Right.
I doubt those will be brought. One could imagine a civil suit. I think that would be even much harder to do. I think the impeachment process is the process for this. We could bar the Trump from ever running for federal office again.
So when you say that the process, let me just ask you this, Brad, really quickly. When you say that the process is the proper one, is that impliedly saying that it's constitutional?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, there was another instance in our country where a corrupt Secretary of War was impeached after he had resigned, and the Senate went ahead with the trial. Now, as it happened, they didn't convict for the same reason that I don't think Trump will be convicted, and that is it takes a two-thirds vote. And they did not get a two-thirds vote back in the 1870s.
Yeah.
And I don't, but they went ahead with the trial.
So it was more of a political thing versus testing the Constitution.
Yes.
Yeah, we have to take a quick break. We're going to talk about foreign affairs after the break for a few minutes with Congressman Brad Sherman. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We're back. We're talking to Congressman Brad Sherman. We only have a few more minutes with Congressman Sherman. Brad, I want to ask you a few questions about some of the issues that we're dealing with and that you've been specifically involved with in the world, foreign affairs. You've been very active since the new administration. Tell us a little bit about where you've been putting some energy in the world and why it's important.
Well, we need to rebuild our relationships around the world, re-enter the Paris Climate Accords, and especially re-enter the World Health Organization. People think that, oh, we'll get vaccinated in the United States and then we're safe. We're not safe until the rest of the world is safe, and I'll tell you why. There are 7 billion people outside the United States. Every time one of them gets infected, there's virus that replicates. When viruses replicate, they mutate. And even if we were all vaccinated, and that's many, many months away, it's possible that these mutations will be immune to the vaccination. So by working with the World Health Organization to suppress this disease, we reduce the number of people who get it in the months to come, and reduce the number of opportunities the vaccine has to mutate in a harmful way. Especially rebuilding our relationship with Europe is important, and we have to show Russia that there are consequences for their hacking, whether it's the hacking of the Democratic National Committee email back in 2016 or their recent a massive hacking attack against U.S. institutions that was discovered just a month or so ago.
What about the conflicts around the world that have been rearing their ugly head? I know you sent a letter recently regarding supporting Artsakh, the Armenian issue. Tell us about that and as well the Burma situation.
Well, we provide a lot of aid to Burma because they did move toward democracy. Now the army has taken over again. But even before the army took over in the last couple of weeks, even with the civilian semi-control of that government, its treatment of the Rohingya minority was just outrageous. They have denied those people citizenship documents for decades, and I do think we have to reevaluate our relationship with Burma or Myanmar. As to Artsakh, here you had a stable situation, and Azerbaijan launched an offensive, and you now have a surrounded and beleaguered Armenian community in much of the Artsakh Republic. We can't accept that as the final as a permanent situation. We need to make sure that the Armenians that are surrounded in Artsakh have a connection to Armenia by road, and that their self-determination is respected. There were many hundreds of people killed. It was unprovoked, and the Armenians have been living in that area for literally thousands
of years, for sure. And Turkey's involvement also brought in Israel. What do you see as the Israel effects on not only that conflict, but what's going on in the Middle East and with the new administration?
Well, the new administration will keep our embassy in Jerusalem, and that makes sense just because that is the capital of the country. And you want your ambassador to be there in every country. We moved our embassy from Bonn to Berlin when Germany moved its capital. We do have the Abrahamic Accords, where Israel now has official diplomatic relations with several Arab states. That's a step in the right direction. But now we have to get, finally, a peace settlement with the Palestinians, and we have to, it has to be a viable Palestinian state. There is no solution other than a two-state solution.
And what about the threat of the Iran nuclear attacks and the deal being resurrected?
On the Iran deal, are you asking?
Yeah.
Look, we have got to, Iran has moved toward a nuclear weapon over the last couple of years. We've got to turn that around, bring Iran into compliance with the deal, and then make the deal better by requiring Iran to stay in compliance. The one biggest flaw of the Iran nuclear deal was that it proposed that in the latter part of this decade, Iran would not be, you know, would still get the economic benefits of a lifting of U.S. sanctions, but would be free to have an unlimited number of centrifuges, et cetera. So we need to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon by keeping them permanently under the limits that they're supposed to be under now.
All right. Well, we'll see how it all turns out. I appreciate the time today, Congressman Brad Sherman. He tweets at Brad Sherman. His website is sherman.house.gov or bradsherman.com. Lots of ways to follow Brad Sherman. Thanks again for being with us on Gervie's Law today.
Thank you very much, Alan.
All right. Take care. All right. Bye-bye. When we come back, we're going to talk about Boys State, Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss after this. And we are back. I'm Alan Gervey. This is Gervey's Law, and we're turning to two guests now who know each other very well because they're married. But does anyone have any idea how tough it is to get 94% on the tomato meter on Rotten Tomatoes? Just about impossible. And win the Sundance U.S. Documentary Grand Jury Prize. Unheard of. It is really quite a feat. And I'll tell you, I really enjoyed the film, Boys State. It's riveting. It really is. There's so many great reviews. One of them from Harrison Abbott says, Boys State is the political story of 2020. Forget about the impeachment of Trump, by the way. This is an honest look at a world many of us had no idea about, but you'll be hooked from the start. We're going to talk now to Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss, the filmmakers of Boys State. Welcome to Gervey's Law.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Hey there.
It's great to have both of you. You know, sometimes I have guests on their telephone and they both have the same voice. This is easy. I can either ask the question to Amanda or Jesse. But I have to say that it is such a fascinating look at this American Legion sponsored event, a week-long exercise in self-government using the political system. And it took place in Austin, Texas. There's a girls' state as well, but this is boys' state. And it's high school students who get accepted in the program. They're split into two parties. They run political campaigns for several positions, including the governor. How did you guys get interested in such a fascinating program that American Legion sponsors?
Yeah, it's such a great microcosm of our democracy. And the idea of watching teenage boys in Texas try to build a government, we thought would be a great window into the challenges of this political moment in our country, which we know are enormous. But it was a way to have the conversation without talking about what was happening in Washington, which, as you know, sort of consumes almost the entire conversation. And we thought this might be a fresh way in. And show us what young people were thinking about and processing.
You know, it's interesting because I think, Jesse, you said that the film wasn't about Donald Trump. Thank you. But the need to find other ways of talking about what's wrong with the country. How do we keep this conversation going? Because you can watch, and of course, everyone should watch. It's Apple TV Plus. Easy, so easy to watch Boys State, and you'll really be thankful you did. But how do we keep this conversation going that's really started by this film that you made? Amanda?
I think it's important. Hi there. Okay, I think it is really important to keep this conversation going because one of the things that's been great with this film is as a text over the year, last year through the election and now post-election, is using it as a text to talk about, as you say, the problems with representational democracy, electoral politics, all the sort of dynamics we see play out in every election, frankly, are existing in this sort of fake election at Texas Boys State 2018. And it all plays out and is, I think, worth a watch for that reason.
What's great about the film, too, we've discovered is it really connects with young people, you know, who are looking at what's happening around them and really freaked out by the polarization and division in our country. And this film shows young people like them wrestling with these questions of what is my role in this democracy and, you know, how flexible am I or how fixed am I in my political identity? And the young men we meet in this film, what's so cool about the program is they come from really different backgrounds politically and ethnically and socioeconomically, and they get together and try to work it out. And what does working it out look like? We haven't seen much of that in Washington, which is kind of stuck in gridlock.
Right, exactly.
And watching these young men try to find common ground is really a fascinating experiment and does, I think, point us towards a hopeful future.
You know, I'm glad you brought it up because, you know, I got to tell you, and I'm not the first to say this if you look at some of the comments, that it's really kind of frightening seeing some of these young men, as you call them, the boys in Boys State. They are so, I don't know what the word would be. I mean, first of all, they're very bright and they come from all different walks of life, but they're so committed and dedicated. It doesn't seem like they are the average person. So when you talk about the teenagers or the young men and young women who are watching the film and really getting into it, it really sets the bar very high. How was it dealing with some of these exceptional kids who some might think are a little bit freakish or maybe a little nerdy in their real focus on the political system?
Well, you know, we don't necessarily say that they're representative of every teenage boy in Texas. We follow four boys in the film, and they are, as you point out, exceptionally bright, really ambitious, really complicated kids. And they just grabbed us. And I think they'll grab our audience. They made us laugh. They made us cry. And they surprised us. And that's really what you want in a documentary, is to be surprised. You know, the kid who we thought was a goofball, you know, kind of has a change of heart. And, well, the kid who says he's going to practice dirty tricks does, in fact, do that. And then this sweet, soulful kid who's the son of Mexican immigrants, who you think has no chance because he's a Bernie Sanders supporter in the sea of conservative white boys, he does remarkably well, and he becomes our kind of underdog hero. And he was really inspiring. So they're not representative of every teenager, but they're just really compelling kids.
Amanda, why is Stephen Garza such a poignant character? You know, you walk away thinking of him.
I think he, for us, was our North Star. He's just one of these people who I think has an innate talent. He has an innate empathy. You can't really fake that. And it works in this space. Like I've seen real politicians, and he just has that thing. And to see him summon the better angels of this particular group, which frankly sort of start as a Lord of the Flies at the beginning of the week.
Yeah, for sure.
Was one of the more extraordinary reminders for me of the potential of our democracy. If you get a leader like him in the room, he really can create this unified group. And that was extraordinary to watch. And that's the American dream. We also show, as you mentioned, the American nightmare in that space. And I think it's important to look at those two things together.
It's interesting, Amanda, you bring up William Golding's Lord of the Flies. And I think a lot of people will think about that. We read it maybe when we were in high school or whenever we read it. It's always been a poignant point, I think, in a lot of people's lives. When you think about how it translates into more of a modern day political environment, Robert McDougall, who was of the Nationalist Party, said it, this gave me a new appreciation of why politicians lie to get into office. Jesse, what does that mean to you? How do you explain that?
That's right. Robert McDougall, one of our main characters, has a kind of moral reckoning. He thinks that he can get elected by lying and by really playing to what he thinks is the kind of lowest common denominator of this rowdy group. And what he discovers, though, is that they actually respond more to Stephen. And I think that Robert has this confession in the film, which came as a surprise to us. We had no idea that he was lying about his political views. But as he points out, you can't get elected on a minority opinion, right? And so he tries to cobble together a coalition, a majority, based on what he thinks their political leanings are. And in fact, it's Stephen, this unlikely kid, who finds a very different and very honest strategy. And I think these two boys, Stephen and Robert, they go head to head. And it's beautiful to watch Robert, who's really handsome, and he's like right out of Dazed and Confused or Friday Night Lights. He's like the quarterback, and he's great looking, and yet he doesn't win, and or at least he it's much harder for him than he thinks. I don't want to spoil everything. But,
right. Don't spoil it.
What's beautiful about the program is it's a kind of crucible that really forces these young men to confront these difficult choices that, as Robert points out, are the same choices that adult politicians have to make. What are they willing to sacrifice to get elected?
You know, it's great that you bring that up, because it works on so many different levels, not only the political level, but there's this psychological underpinning that goes throughout the whole film about each kid, and you try to get into their minds, and it's very hard because they have come from different environments and different cultures. But you look at these kids and you think, this program, who had famous people like Bill Clinton and Cory Booker and Dick Cheney and Rush Limbaugh, who were involved in it back in the day, what do you expect to see from some of these kids that you actually followed and filmed for the film?
Well, we did the math. I think it's Garza 2048. I think they all have, great futures. They're all really impressive. They're all very different, the four kids we followed. And they all have different journeys already, even though it's only 2 years later. At 20, they're in college. One's at West Point. One's, you know, heavily involved in activism. One is wants to be in national security. And then Stephen really has been working in electoral politics, trying to get other people, local congressional races. And, you know, that's his path. And they all are so dedicated to this country. I think that one of the values of the program that we responded to was this idea that democracy is not a spectator sport. And whether that's in elections or activism or actually in the, you know, serving in the military, whatever it is, just they're so engaged. And so for that reason, I think all of them have very, very bright futures.
You know, maybe you just came up with another, or you did in the past, another idea for a new film, which is Whatever Happened to the 2018 Boys State Boys. Maybe that's another film.
I can tell you, yeah, we'd love to do that. But we're also going to make Girl State. And we're actually in development right now on that project because we think it's really the necessary sibling. We don't call it a sequel.
Right.
But we want to see how girls are navigating this political moment. And so we're looking at different states, not going to be in Texas.
I think it's great. You know, I'm so happy to hear you're looking at that because, you know, I would love to watch this from the girls' perspective and get into their minds as well and even make some comparisons with the boys. This is on Apple TV Plus, real easy. Are there any other outlets where people can see Boys State?
Well, Apple TV Plus, but we're also working with Apple to get it into classrooms, and we've done a lot of screenings on college campuses. So if you're an educator or have a group, an activist group, and you think this film would fit in, and you're a teacher, definitely reach out, and Apple can help to make that happen.
And how do people reach out, either to you, Amanda McBain, and Jesse Moss, or for the film, to get them the opportunity to do that?
Yeah, they can reach out to boystate.movie. It has our curriculum guide for the film, which is really cool, that Apple developed. And they can also reach out to jessemoss.com. Our contact info is there. And by all means, reach out and we'll make it happen.
And I love seeing the commercials. I'm seeing them on a daily basis. I'm sure, you know, the $12 million that Apple TV acquired it for is paying off in spades. So congratulations, both you, Amanda and Jesse, and appreciate all that great work you did for this film, Boys State.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today.
Take care.
All right, you too. And that's going to do it for another edition of Gervie's Law. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.